Welcome back to Backstory. I'm Peter Runniff, 18th century guy, here with Ed Ayers.
You're a 19th century guy.
And Brian Ballow.
I'm your 20th century guy. Today on our show, we're doing memorials, their histories and their controversies. Guys, let's take a trip out west to the Black Hills of South Dakota. We are going to Mount Rushmore.
Hey, I was there in 1953.
You know what? And I was there in 1999, and it looked exactly the same.
Wow, same four guys up there?
Yeah, so yep, they hadn't added anybody.
Yeah, now, can you remember which ones?
Yeah, there are four guys, yep. Washington, Jefferson, Lincoln, and Teddy Roosevelt.
Two Virginians.
Mm-hmm. Okay. They were literally blown into existence between 1927 and 1941. Their heads now are 60 feet tall, and they are 5,000 feet above sea level. Rushmore's sculptor was a pretty prolific guy, and his name, Gutzon Borglum.
Are you saying that backwards?
Gutzon Borglum was sort of a celebrity sculptor. Borglum developed a lot of the techniques that he would use eventually at Mount Rushmore at another iconic work of his, Stone Mountain, the Confederate monument in Atlanta.
Yeah, a monument to blowing up the Union, right?
Yes, he liked blowing things up, no doubt. Mount Rushmore was going to be his way of putting it all back together, Peter. It was going to be his grand opus to American territorial expansion. The mountain was once a sacred part of the Lakota Sioux tribal lands, but the U.S. government found some gold there, and I think you know the rest of that story. That was the Cliff Notes version, and we all know you can't get more than a B+ with Cliff Notes. We are an A plus show, and to get an A plus on this one, you've really got to go to the visitor center at the base of Mount Rushmore, and better yet, go into that darkened auditorium and watch the video that they show you about the monument, the orientation video. Now, Mount Rushmore has gone through three of these orientation videos, the first one in 1965, the next in 73, and the one that's currently running was made in 1986.
Hey, how about the one that was running in 1953?
That was a film strip, Peter.
Oh, that's why I don't remember those videos.
Well, kind of like the monuments that we've been talking about, these videos really tell you more about the times that they were made in than about the monuments themselves. A professor who noticed this was Teresa Bergman. She's a professor at the University of the Pacific, and she walked me through all three videos, starting with the first one made in 1965.
Let us place there, carved high, as close to the heavens as we can.
So this first film spends, from my point of view, an inordinate amount of time explaining who Gutzon Borglum is.
Right.
And almost every other shot, you see another shot of Borglum somehow, even during the blasting and the chiseling. He's in almost every shot.
But Borglum said, Gutzon Borglum. Borglum had already begun to frame his Borglum, had come to South Dakota. When Gutzon Borglum returned to Mount Rushmore in 1925.
I think my favorite part of this film is actually the last shot, because we have this crossfade of Gutzon Borglum with a fedora at an angle, of course. And it's crossfaded his images above Mount Rushmore. So there is no question that the main message of this film is that Mount Rushmore is Gutzon Borglum.
Yeah. Yeah. Was there a movement to put his head there as the fifth? probably not. Why do you think they made this kind of film in 1965? And what does the film say about that period in American history?
Well, that's a really good question. In 65, in the U.S., there was a lot of contention. There was civil disobedience, demonstrations, beginnings of problems with Vietnam, civil rights movement, and the government itself is not to be trusted. So what you have going on in this first film is a very, I think, conscious decision not to interpret Rushmore the way Borglum would have interpreted it in terms of manifest destiny, U.S. expansionism and imperialism, but let's just look at this person in particular and who he was and what he did and not focus on the meaning so much. Let's focus on him. Well, we're in 1973 now.
Okay. Now, if 1965 witnessed a certain amount of division, 1973, all hell is breaking loose.
Yep. So what we get, the way the whole dissonance and the civil disobedience and not such civil disobedience is incorporated in the explanation of the choice of each of the presidents, they're all defined in how they survived discord, internal discord in the nation.
Very interesting.
Washington tried to focus his country's attention on the awesome problems of internal harmony, of a man who, as president, held our country together through a period which nearly melted the foundations of our republic, Abraham Lincoln.
What did the public say to all of this? How was this second film received?
Most of the documents that I read in doing my research is it wasn't received really well by the National Park Service. I didn't see anything from the public, but a lot of the memos and the letters that people wrote to each other were responding to complaints that it wasn't inspirational or
right.
uplifting
right.
The way the previous film was. The third film, and it's the film that's still showing, came out in 1986, and the narrator is Tom Brokaw, and it's been received really well. And I think that's mostly evidenced by it still showing
right.
after all these years with
right.
no changes whatsoever. I mean, this one is much more in the direction of uplifting and bringing back some previous themes, celebrating Borglum again, and imperialism comes back, and it moved completely away from defining who these presidents were the way it was in the 73 film to let's just focus on how this thing got carved.
And it got carved with lots of dynamite.
Lots of dynamite. One of the most popular exhibits inside the visitor center. It's a simulation of you can actually make dynamite blow up. You have a plunger and you push it down, and there's a video screen, and those images that you see in the documentary and the orientation film of Rushmore blowing up, those are shown as you push down.
Well, you've referred to the historical context of the first two films, so close the loop. What's going on? Why would this be emphasized?
Well, it's 1986 when this film comes out. And it takes such a different tack than the 73 film because they weren't really pleased with that film. And one of the ways to not get involved in the politics and move away from that, which had happened in the second film, is look at how it was made. And let's look at workers and let's
right.
focus on, not on the politics, not on the meaning. Let's just be celebratory. And the way we can do this without being too political is to look at the people who worked on it and not even focus on Borglum too much.
It is a monument no less to the men who, working together, transformed a lofty dream into a colossal reality, a work of art for the ages.
You know, I have a very mixed experience when I go to Mount Rushmore. It's awe-inspiring. I mean, you can't help but be awestruck, and it is so massive. But at the same time, I'm very perplexed that we would do this to a mountain in the Black Hills and that it's still contested who owns the Black Hills. And none of that is even represented on the site at all. I feel like a big part of the history, like anything before Borglum, before the carvings, very little about that is there.
Teresa Bergman is a professor at University of the Pacific. She has a book coming out about these videos and the videos at a bunch of other monuments called Exhibiting Patriotism, Creating and Contesting Interpretations of American Historic Sites.
If you're just tuning in, this is Backstory. And we're talking about memorials.
As we were finishing up this show, we got a message from a listener who wanted to talk about a slightly different type of memorial than the ones we've been talking about today. Vicky's from Madison, Wisconsin. Vicky, what do you have for us?
Well, I wanted to tell you the story about how Facebook and social media have changed the way I live in community and live with the memories of people who have passed.
Right.
My dad passed away in 2003 when Facebook was still a gleam in Mark Zuckerberg's eyes. My dad was a really popular dad among my high school friends. He was the fun dad and the dad who actually talked to teenagers like they were people.
Whoa. Wow. Good for him.
And I joined Facebook in 2007 and reconnected with a lot of my old buddies. And when the anniversary of his passing rolled around, I posted some notes about my dad on my Facebook profile. I posted the eulogy that I had presented at his funeral and the obituary that my brother and I had written for him and some pictures of him as a child and as an adult. And it was what made it wonderful for me was that it reconnected me with my high school friends, and it also gave my new friends some sense of my own history and who I came from and where I came from and how I came to be the person that I am. What do you think of the idea of using social media as a new kind of gathering place for memorials, pulling together our sense of our family histories, and also kind of virtual, I don't know how to say it, virtual graveyards that we go back and visit every once in a while?
Well, Vicki, this is Ed. Ed, that's a very interesting question, and I have what may seem like a strange answer. This is a recovery of a much older tradition, I think, that reached its peak in Victorian America in the 19th century, and that we worked very hard to forget in the 20th century. They dwelt on the memory of people they'd lost that they loved with a kind of care and openness that struck subsequent generations as a little strange. You know, so you can see framed memorials made of people's hair that, you know, that have been cut and then woven into rosettes or into, you know, other kinds of things that you would hang on the wall. People would make all these elaborate scrapbooks of all the things that came in at the time of a funeral. Brian, I'm going to sort of kick it to you a little bit because it strikes me that somehow in the early 20th century, this tradition came to seem inappropriate and certainly was lost, and that the idea of a funeral came to be to get rid of death as quickly as possible and then to move on. Am I wrong about thinking that?
No, I think you're right, Ed. And unfortunately, I think we have kind of science to blame for this. We have the medical profession to blame for this. And we have this notion of the sanitized death to blame for this, and most of all, a kind of specialization of life where we developed professional undertakers and bodies were taken away. If I'm not wrong, people died in their homes in your century, and there was a real presence of the body. Of course, that's true of Peter's period.
I mean, the presence of the lost one, the dead person, was the basis, you might say, of spiritualism in the 19th century, that is communicating across that barrier, didn't seem all that far when the genius of the house, the people who had lived there, there was a sense of the imminence of the presence of the past in the 19th century that you certainly don't have in the 20th and 21st.
As a person who took us immediately back to the pre-internet era to talk about Vicki's direct question about the effect of the internet, I feel a responsibility to bring us back. It is interesting what would otherwise have been just folded away quietly, maybe shared on a birthday or at a holiday with just a few people. Now we understand that those same reminders speak to a far larger group of people than we might have thought. Yeah. It strikes me as that it seems less lonely now with the sharing of social media. Am I right, Vicki? I thought I heard in your voice a certain sense of
recovery. That you make me think of is I have a friend who passed away a couple of years ago And his Facebook profile was never taken down by his family. And when his birthday rolls around, everybody who was on his friend list gets an announcement. Today is such and so's birthday.
Mm-hmm.
And I go to his page and I see that people have come to his page and wished him a happy birthday in heaven and talk about the things that they remember about him. And it's almost like going and laying flowers on the grave on the anniversary, which Facebook reminds us of. But it also keeps us removed because we don't actually have to deal with it in a physical way.
What it reminds me, and I'm going to sound like Ed again, maybe it's just because the 19th century is the most important century, but I'm thinking of the proliferation of genealogies, county histories, local histories, but most importantly, genealogies in the 19th century. It was the ultimate textual printed form of this keeping family memories alive. And I think what you've got is kind of a living mega genealogy in the internet, at least potentially.
No, it is interesting, as Peter was suggesting, that genealogy is perhaps the most popular activity a legitimate nature on the internet. That you know, it's one of the first things that people have done is to use this.
That's right.
Both for the purposes that Vicki is saying, but also to connect with people who were your ancestors long ago. So it's fascinating. Apparently, this longing for personal memorialization, not so much a quest for individual immortality, but to understand where we fit, may I say it, into the flow of history.
Yeah.
Seems to be enabled now in a way that it simply wasn't before.
Vicki, terrific call. Thank you for calling.
Thank you so much for taking my call.
They made a statue of us and put it on a mountaintop. Tourists come and stare at us, blow bubbles with their gum, take photographs of fun, have fun.
That's going to do it for this week. Tell us about the memorials in your town at backstoryradio.org. There, you'll find this show and all of our past episodes available for free. You can also look ahead to upcoming shows and leave your questions about those topics. That's at backstoryradio.org.
Backstory is produced by Jess Ingebretson, Eric Mennel, and Anna Pinkert. Our senior producer is Tony Feel.
Nell Beschenstein is our researcher, and Jamal Milner is technical director. We had help from Frank Cirillo. Backstory's executive producer is the inimitable Andrew Windham.
Special thanks today to George Rutherford, Paul Shackle, and Stu and Polly Wharton. Major support for Backstory is provided by the National Endowment for the Humanities, the Joseph and Robert Cornell Memorial Foundation, the University of Virginia, Weinstein Properties, an anonymous donor, and the History Channel. History made every day.
Peter Onuf and Brian Ballow are professors in the University of Virginia's Corcoran Department of History. Ed Ayers is president and professor of history at the University of Richmond. Backstory was created by Andrew Windham for the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities.